every individual reaction was specific, idiosyncratic, which means absolutely related to the previous experience. Even the symptoms were formed and could be understood as a shape of the current reaction to adult trauma, but shaped according to a childhood experience.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and Off the Couch. This podcast was created in order to share with our colleagues and the community at large the many activities that psychoanalysts are involved in around the world that go beyond their individual clinical work in their consulting rooms. We have conversations with psychoanalysts who work with medically ill patients, who work in refugee centers, who work in community mental health centers, who work with police departments, with the United Nations, with business leaders, analysts who teach undergraduates, who work in prisons. There's a whole variety of quite remarkable work that analysts are bringing to various venues around the world. When COVID struck us all, we shifted our attention and we began meeting with analysts and talking with analysts again around the world to learn firsthand how they were dealing with this crisis and with the sudden shift to online treatment. And we've learned that different cultures, analytic cultures and political cultures, entail both similarities and differences among each other in how we're all facing this crisis. As part of that effort, we also began speaking with some of the elders in our field. And by elders, I mean those who've been practicing analysis for 40 to 50 years. And we asked them to reflect on this quite unique period of history and to also share their vision of our profession and how it's evolved for them over their many decades. In addition, psychoanalysis has always had a point of view about the societies in which we live. And we've been discussing with clinicians and psychoanalytic researchers on this new wave of othernesses that has been almost virus-like in wrapping the world, where groups of people from all vantage points are being treated as cold others. And there's something about our common humanity that is more and more difficult for us to hold on to. And analysts have a great deal to say about that, and we've been discussing that with colleagues again from around the world. And we're going to continue focusing on these three areas: work that analysts do off the couch, reflections on what COVID is doing to all of us, and hopefully what it will be like for us as we leave COVID hopefully behind, and also the reflections that we analysts have on the societies in which we live. I hope you enjoy these conversations. Please feel free to comment on our website, ipaoffthecouch.org. And thank you for listening. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Vladimir Jovich. Dr. Jovich is a psychiatrist and a psychoanalyst in private practice in Belgrade, Serbia. And since the early 90s, Dr. Jovich has been working with refugees and war veterans and victims of torture in former Yugoslavia. In 1997, together with other colleagues, he established the Center for Rehabilitation of Torture Victims, CRTV, in Belgrade, where they've employed a variety of psychosocial programs that were developed in the framework of rehabilitation of the torture victims. And we're going to spend some time in today's conversation learning about what those psychosocial programs are and how they fit into an overall program of psychological treatment. Dr. Jovich was active in the development of independent mechanisms for the prevention of torture in places of detention, such as prisons and psychiatric hospitals, through the National Preventive Mechanism. And today, he works as a consultant for the CRTV and has been newly appointed member of the Board of Trustees of the United Nations Voluntary Fund for Victims of Torture. In our conversation, we discuss how one can engage with those who have been involved in torture, It's not the usual way of people walking into our offices. The importance of psychosocial outreach, making sure that basic needs of these individuals are met. And he describes really traveling the countryside, making contact with people who have been traumatized. It's really the definition of our overall theme of this podcast, Psychoanalysis Off the Couch. We discuss the role of culture as facilitating the acting out of aggression. We talk about the usefulness and limitations of PTSD and the whole subject of current trauma and how it stands in relation to childhood vulnerabilities and the complications that come from using a binary system. And we also get to know a bit about his own personal history and his involvement in this work and that of his colleagues. I found it a deeply moving and important subject that we don't usually hear in psychoanalytic settings, but he introduces it with both an eye towards the practical and the eye towards the depth. And I learned a lot, and I enjoyed this conversation. I hope you do as well. Here's my conversation with Dr. Vladimir Jovich. Vladimir, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Glad to share this time with you. Vladimir, psychoanalysis hasn't had a long history with those who have been involved with torture. It isn't often that victims of torture make it to our office. And it isn't often that perpetrators of torture or other wartime, shall we say, violent or criminal acts make it to our offices. And the key phrase in that sentence is make it to our offices. Because we know it's a complicated experience for someone to make it to an analyst's office. It takes some basic sense of safety. It takes a basic capacity to mentalize in order to imagine that engaging with another person can somehow be transformative and healing. And it's those very two states of mind that are weakened, if not shattered, in the torture experience. And what your work has taught us, and we're going to learn more about today from you, is that there needs to be something preparatory. And that before one is able to address psychological needs of victims of torture, one must attend to their basic needs. And your having learned that led you to set up programs where these individuals are fed, they're clothed, they're taught, they're provided medical care and legal care. And one might have a sense that there's an effort to reawaken what are hopefully present, which are old good objects in them and old capacities for good object relatedness. And it is only after those basic needs are reestablished that one can attend to the psychological needs. So you've been involved with this for a long time. How did you learn to work with those who have been involved with torture?
I have to start with the context. It was mid-90s, so it's 25 years ago, and the wars in Bosnia and Croatia were still going on. And we had waves and waves of refugees coming to Serbia and to Belgrade. At that time, I was still working in psychiatric clinic, and I was a resident, and we started to see either refugees or war veterans or torture survivors. And we were all puzzled how we can help them with it's completely different picture than we used to. A little bit later, we developed a kind of trauma center or counseling center that was meant to be specialized for psychological treatment of refugees, war veterans, and torture survivors, with a very simple idea to have a counseling office, to have a chairs and table and start talking with them. And of course, it didn't work really well because, as we know now, it's very difficult for torture survivor, for example, to be coming to ask for help, to ask for a psychological help, and especially to be involved into, let's say, long-term psychotherapy or especially psychoanalysis. So we started with offering them as what you enlisted as a quite different help assistance, either direct medical assistance or legal help, education for their children or other support for their families, which was basically a learning by doing, because we were offering what they were asking for, and we had a great support from people in the international agencies who were willing to finance those kind of activities. And then it's gradually start to be transformed into real psychological work, where we could offer group analytic therapy or individual counseling, real psychological, psychotherapeutic work. Later, probably, we would understand that we had to create a safe environment where these people could feel not only trust and understanding, but also to feel a human connectedness or human response from caretakers, which I started to value more and more as the time was going on. So it was described as psychological or psychosocial interventions. It was late 90s, early 2000s, and we were still not elaborating what methodologically could be described as psychosocial. But now we know, and we can use psychoanalytical theories about the role of the environment, of social relations, of culture, to understand how much we need to intervene within social environment before we go into psychotherapy.
And was there something unique about the psychotherapy that you were able to then engage some of these individuals with that reflected both the prior basic need provisions that you were doing and the nature of their trauma? That is, what did you learn from the more depth psychological treatment you were able to engage them with?
Well, first of all, our interventions were intertwined and overlapping. I, for example, completely lost the position of psychoanalyst with neutral attitude or staying in the office and waiting for clients. We were moving around the country in mobile teams. We were bringing the medicines in boxes and bringing them to specialized clinics. And so it was very proactive attitude, which is completely different than the regular, let's say, psychoanalytical practice.
Sure. It was,
first of all, the other thing is that to go into a deeper layers of understanding of trauma, we had to rely on something else than just description of traumatic memory and looking for traumatic memory, bringing it into the light. Instead, we were probably much more into the open space, looking for some clues, how to approach to those people, what kind of material they would like to bring in, and really forget about the theories of trauma that existed at that time, theory that we should work on traumatic event or to bring it into the narratives and so on. So it was very often discussion about very different things, either from a current lifetime or from a wartime period, which is not only related to trauma, but to life expectations, understanding of human relationships, what is culture and what is human nature, what is society and what is the destruction of civilization and so on. Very wide topics.
You don't mention in that list of wide topics their childhoods, and I don't know if that's an oversight or by intention.
Oh, no. From my understanding, it is extremely important, but it's really rarely that we come to these topics at the beginning.
Oh, sure. No, I didn't mean at the beginning.
Yeah, it's only much later that we can, let's say, understand the reactions to war related trauma as a kind of specific individual reaction, which is shaped by the childhood experience.
And did you find that?
Absolutely. I can say that every individual reaction was specific, idiosyncratic, which means absolutely related to the previous experience. Even the symptoms were formed and could be understood in as a shape of the current reaction to adult trauma, but shaped according to a childhood experience.
I ask that in particular because in your reading, my reading of what you've written, you have thoughts about post-traumatic stress disorder, that diagnosis, which I'm interested in our discussing. I was working in the late 70s, early 80s with Vietnam veterans, and that was just when PTSD was being born. And it was born in controversy, as these things tend to be. And the field was struggling in, unfortunately, a binary way. There was the dynamic community that emphasized the importance of the childhood and the predispositions to being disabled by trauma. And they felt that focusing on PTSD, the current trauma, would lean away from learning about just what you said, the individual proclivities. And then, of course, there were the people who were very much for the diagnosis of PTSD, saying many things, one of which is there's something important to know about the nature of the current overwhelming trauma that is freestanding, that isn't defined and represented by the childhood. And B, the emphasis on the childhood is sort of, they saw it as blaming the victim as opposed to appreciating the current circumstance and perhaps some blame that might be reasonably applied to the sources of the current trauma. And there were bitter fights. I think nowadays the field has matured so that one doesn't have to choose. One can be exquisitely sensitive, as you just described being, to the current trauma. And then with those for whom it is indicated, you can eventually get to, yes, the current trauma stands on its own, and yes, it is also influenced by the minds that we bring to it.
Oh, yes, absolutely. It would really be a very binary view to discuss whether the childhood trauma or current trauma is more important. I'll give you just a brief example. During the NATO bombing of Serbia and Belgrade in 1999, I was talking with my friends and just casually asking them what is the worst fear that they can have right now in case that, I don't know, they were hit by a bomb or something. And there were just a few different answers. One is, I don't want to stay alive and be losing some limbs or legs or something. Or one would say, I don't want to lose my close relatives or my people that I rely on, which would be separation anxiety, I suppose. Or something like, I just imagine to be annihilated just to stop being something. So you have very specific individual fears, reactions. But what is important about PTSD, it's, as you say, it's a very important concept, and it helped people, victims, and those who suffered to gain treatment, to gain recognition, and it was of immense importance. On the other hand, when we look at its clinical value, we see that it's based on descriptive methodology, which means definite collection of symptoms, which we don't see very often in clinical practice. First of all, we have a variety of other problems that people are suffering from, like different somatization, like substance abuse, different psychosomatic illnesses like diabetes or hypertension, which is excluded from a overall clinical picture, but it is definitely a consequence of psychological trauma. The other thing is symptoms are changing over the time, and they can appear or reappear or take a completely different form, as we know from the understanding of dynamics. And then we have all these comorbidity issues and so on and so on. So the other thing is that PTSD is basically based on implicit theory of traumatic memory. And we can discuss it, but what we are interested in is this loss of capacity for mentalization, which is more a story about the loss of ego functions or lots of psychological functions that help us to survive or to cope with external stress, which is, let's say, more important for me. So, and then again, you know, the concept of PTSD and the trauma, it's something like etiologically defined, which means the trauma is causing the disorder. And it's very often difficult to define what is the trauma that is causing disorder. And we see that without individual meaning of trauma, you cannot understand PTSD. And very recently we had a case, because I am now supervising some psychologists who are working with the refugees from Middle East and North Africa. So they are mostly adolescents, young men who were severely traumatized, tortured. Mm-hmm. Some of them were involved in war activities. And there was a case of a young man who was, as a child, being sent to a front line, being child soldier, let's say, and he described horrible events that he went through. And on the other hand, he didn't show any kind of traumatization, let's say, any kind of psychological disturbance. And my younger colleague simply asked, how is it possible that he got traumatized? My answer is, it's because his trauma did not become traumatic still. The event has to become traumatic in our psyche to show its really pathogenic effects. What happened not too long afterwards is that this young man learned about the destiny of his family, and then he came with a completely developed, let's say, clinical picture of psychological trauma, with the nightmares, with the guilt, with the anxieties, with the depression, and so on and so on. And we know that from the, how you call it, deferred action or Nachträglichkeit, or
yeah,
that we the traumatic event needs to become a trauma in psyche to show its pathogenity.
You've also had reflections on the role of the political culture in which we all live, but played out in with some of the victims that you've worked with, and how political cultures can allow the acting out of impulses that are otherwise kept outside of action.
Mm.
Can you share more about that?
Yes. Well, we were observing a lot of crimes against civilians, against prisoners of war, and so on. And it was, from the beginning, it was some kind of discussion among us. Why would that be so? What is the rationale, if it's possible to say like that, for such a cruel violence? Later, when we started to analyze other circumstances, other environments where people are detained and dehumanized, we started to understand that the real torture, physical torture, or the physical atrocities toward the some groups are just the extreme consequence of psychological process of dehumanization, which is happening not only in the war. Of course, the most extreme forms are during the war, either from wartime propaganda, where the enemy is dehumanized, but also to concrete actions against the civilians of other ethnicity, race, whatever it is, religion, and so on. For us, understanding of the interpersonal violence was really developing when we understood the same processes of dehumanization in prisons, in psychiatric institutions, in social asylums, where we could see that the concrete extreme forms of physical violence are just the consequences of the much wider and psychological mechanisms of dehumanization, which has to be supported on a wider level. So if you have institution, you can observe that this, within this institution, there is a culture of dehumanization. And you can look at it very easily. You can recognize it very easily. If that culture is present, it's almost always supported by some kind of ideology. It could be implicit or explicit, but this ideology, it could be nationalistic, xenophobic, it could be professional, like in psychiatric institutions where, for example, schizophrenic patients are considered as dangerous or irreparably damaged or so on and so on. So there's always some kind of ideology, and it's mostly pseudoscience without real concrete scientific data that can support it. But then you have environment, which is dehumanizing, and then you have acts of violence, which are not sanctioned, which are not recognized as a violence. There is a culture of impunity. And then you have possible crimes against humanity on a large scale, like it's happening during the war. Now, right now, we have this very similar situation with refugees who are trying to pass the borders and to come to Europe. I know that something similar is happening in North America as well, but focusing here in European territory, we see horrible crimes against these families and adolescents who are crossing borders, they say illegally, but they are refugees and their status should be recognized. Their rights should be protected by international law. Instead, there is a hidden consent by a government, both in Balkans but in Europe as well, that they should be stopped, they should be expelled. There are many reports about the horrible violence against them done by the governmental officials, either by police, by border patrols, border guards, and many cases where they were beaten, tortured, police dogs were unleashed to them. We have photographs, we have forensic examinations, many documents supporting it, but it's still hidden because there is obviously, wide accepted support from the governments and from the, I would say, societies, that this is the way how they should be treated to protect, Europe, countries of Europe, or whatever it is, how they are perceived as foreign elements. That's just an example. There are many examples from wars in Yugoslavia or other wars, but this is the way how the dehumanization is supported by the ideology.
And when you work with those who are on the receiving end of that dehumanization, you see how they are affected by it?
Oh, yes. There are two possible ways how to look at it. For me, the most important part is to understand the consequences of torture that appear to happen in victims of torture. And as we know from many descriptions from Second World War and much later, it's those people do show extreme forms of psychological sequela. Their psychological functioning is severely damaged, I would say. So they lost capacities to work, to love, to relate, to enjoy life, to be with other people, and all the way up to the basic psychological functions like sleeping, eating. So in most of the time after the concentration camps or torture experiences, they are trying to cope with this, let's say, inner states that are basically overwhelmingly filled with annihilation anxieties, if I may say, and trying to modulate their affects, their anxieties, so that most of the energy is lost in order just to survive the day. So in that sense, their functioning is really very, very bad. But when we look at the dynamics of those things, we see that in order to survive this torture experience or this dehumanization that is done by torturers or perpetrators, they had to split off this inner state of mind that is able to reflect on the suffering and pain and humiliation that's been done to him, and to split off those parts in a very similar way like we see in those who did the crimes toward them. Challenging to compare these things, but it's late, much later it became obvious that in order to integrate those parts, most of them, they had to go through a very severe depressive crisis where they have to challenge many, many things, their lives and their experiences, and it's really painful. When you see moments of this despair, it's really difficult, challenging for therapists as well. On the other hand, when we look at the perpetrators, for example, my experiences are mostly with war veterans. You can call them perpetrators, those were people who were fighting, but also doing many vicious crimes during the war. You see that in order to do those acts of violence, they had to go through the process of dehumanization, which means dehumanize themselves or to be dehumanized by authorities or by the circumstances. And it could be described as a kind of a schizoid process where they had to split off some parts of their psyche which are able to empathize with other people. And if we split off empathy and other, let's say, human characteristics and capacities, then we have the possibility or ability to destroy other human beings, to inflict horrible damages and really do criminal acts. And that's what Bolas described in an article, the fascist state of mind. That really intrigued me, and that it is possible to look at those processes as a splitting off of big chunks of psyche, which are able to be human. So if you look at the soldier, for example, after the war, they describe their acts as some kind of automatic reactions. And when they come to our offices with the psychological crisis, it's very often because this process of reintegration of human parts is taking place. And I was mentioning some cases where the veterans would come in a crisis which is caused by a need to rehumanize their lives. And this is, again, not my concept. I mentioned that to you earlier. It's Chaim Shatan paper on Vietnam veterans and the process of rehumanization as a process of recovery. And then we see, for example, a veteran who is coming with a very severe depressive crisis because he got the first child, for example. And now he's challenged to be engaged into empathic and human relationship. And then he collapsed into severe crisis, remembering all crimes and deeds during the war, and many similar examples.
It's the moment where his ability to love was called up by becoming a father, that he became aware that that's what was closed down in his need to act out hate.
Exactly.
And that underlines the value of, if I understand you, in providing the basic loving needs of those initial encounters is to try to locate those old capacities to be empathically involved with others.
Yeah, it's the importance of this human contact, I think, cannot be underestimated. You can hear it from the narratives of the victims. For example, they would describe many horrors of torture in the concentration camp, and then they would remember a prison guard who would offer them a cigarette. Those are moments where the humanity is re-evoked, I may say. And those were very important moments for...
You know, there's an irony, perhaps, that often when you ask people about their analytic experiences, and they could be long involved, even classically labeled analytic experiences, but they'll say, you know, one time my analyst offered me tissues, or one time my analyst did some gesture akin to offering a cigarette, and how that stands out. Not necessarily that that was the reason they felt it was successful, but that stands out as such a sweet moment, an important moment. And it reminds me of the story you say. I don't know what to make of the analogy between the two settings, and I'm not casting aspersions on the analytic experience, but the moments of tenderness are so powerful. You've had clinical experiences with soldiers as well, soldiers who have done things the way I would back in the day when I would interview Vietnam veterans who came with various symptoms. The way I would ask or approach their wartime history would be to ask them if they had done anything that in retrospect they wish they hadn't. And that turned out to be a useful way for them to feel that it was okay to reflect on things that they wish they hadn't done. Has that kind of thing, that kind of engagement with the soldiers you've worked with, been productive for you in the work with them?
Absolutely. I was sometimes amazed how open and sincere these people would be in the counseling office, and how much honestly they would describe moments when they did something which is wrong by any standards. Sometimes it would be almost looking like a kind of a confession, and those were very important moments for them. Sometimes they would deny that they feel guilt, or they would ask me to not to go into those questions. Like the guy would come and the first sentence would be, "Whatever you ask, don't ask me if I feel guilty." Or they would deny any kind of feeling guilt, and then the man would start crying and just stutter, "They looked like my sons," meaning that he was reminded of enemy soldiers that he probably killed in action. And many different moments where these people were really shattered by the recollection of horrible things that they did or omitted to do. Officers who lost their soldiers or made mistakes, or many, many different, you know, all these complexities of war.
Yes.
And of course, it is challenging to work with those materials. Sometimes it was really unbearable to listen to those things without any judgment. Probably all of us have to go through a personal dialogue, how to cope with those materials and what to do with that. And also, it's very often that I was caught up in thinking how the war is a complex experience where there's really a blurred line between a victim and perpetrator. It's really challenging to split it easily.
Listening to you reminds me of, again, a controversy back in the early days, in the 80s. Often combat veterans would refuse to talk to therapists who were not themselves combat veterans. That they had the sense that you could read all the books you want or treat all the patients you want, unless and until you have been in the throes of combat, you really can't understand their experience. And the field struggled around that as well. Has that come up in your experiences?
At the beginning, they were very isolated. I'm talking just the beginning of the war. And the first individuals who came to our clinic, because it was really exceptional in the Belgrade, those were the first veterans returning from the war. But then our whole society was immersed into trauma. And you will remember NATO bombing in 1999.
So sure.
We were all basically sharing the same experience. So there was a kind of understanding that we were all same side, I would say.
Vladimir, let me shift a little bit. You've devoted much of your professional life to this work. That's unusual, especially not only as a psychiatrist, but as a psychoanalyst. Can you share with us what has led you to decide to do that?
Well, my personal experience for sure, because I was something like 25 when the war started, and I was conscripted to army in the Western Bosnia where I lived at that time. Just by a chance, I managed to escape and to come to Belgrade, where I continue my studies and psychiatric and psychoanalytical training. But it was obviously a very strong impact, because from the first moment I knew that this war will shape my life, and probably my career will be spent on understanding of war. Aggression, if you would like, because only to put these experiences into some meaningful framework would help me to survive psychologically all of these things that happened. And of course, we could not have any idea how long it will take to end these wars and what we will survive. Then on the other hand, when we started to discuss about personal stories and our family stories, it happened that most of my colleagues do have family history of, trauma during the Second World War and even before that. And most of our histories are connected to genocide during the Second World War and survival of our families during the atrocities, which is not difficult to imagine in this part of the world.
Sure.
And the whole Europe, I would say. But it had impact to our careers. I suppose it's much better to recognize it and to deal with it than to neglect the history and to neglect the impact of these events to our lives.
You mentioned it's not surprising that so many clinicians in your part of the world trace something about their life, their development, and their professional work to World War II. I have been surprised to learn in my having conversations with psychoanalysts, not just in Europe, but in the States and South America as well, how often when I ask them about their backgrounds and their stimulus to be interested in the helping work and often quite remarkable work that people do, there are stories related to the war and the Holocaust, where aunts and uncles and grandparents were somehow affected and then had to emigrate and survived. but that's a thread that runs through, and I guess it's a generational thing, but it runs through the world of psychoanalysis in ways that often are hidden unless you ask about it. If there was one thing that was good that came out of those horrible years, it was that the world has been seeded by deeply caring and deeply skillful clinicians to make a positive impact all over the world. And I do want to thank you for your work, for your sharing your time with me and our audience. You have written beautifully, and you have brought forth this notion of dehumanization and rehumanization. And I must say, in the brief time we've gotten to know each other in our conversations, I get that sense from you. I get that sense that you are fully immersed, and that's not a simple process, obviously. You're fully immersed in the complexity of violence and trauma and wartime, and are willing to accept all the ambiguities, and yet keep your eye on that spark of humanity that is in you and that you help locate in the people you work with. And I thank you for sharing it with me, our audience, and through your writing. And I appreciate your spending time with us.
Thank you, Harvey, for these very kind words. This was really nice experience. And thank you for inviting me.
For me as well. Thanks. Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.